Hello, Anne Hawley here. As promised, the Editor Roundtable has now done a complete breakdown of a movie in each of the 12 content genres. We actually hit thriller twice, which gives us a total of 13 episodes, and today we're hitting the big idea nonfiction genre with episode 14. That wraps up season one. After today, we're going to take a little break from posting so we can get a whole new season ready for you. And we'll be back on May 9th with the first of 14 all-new episodes for Season 2 of the Editor Roundtable podcast. We hope you'll be back with us. And now, on with the show.
Welcome to the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better editor, following the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne, an editor with over 25 years' experience. My name is Kim Kessler, and I'll be moderating the roundtable today. Joining me shortly are four of my fellow certified StoryGrid editors, Jari Bolander, Valerie Francis, Anne Hawley, and Leslie Watts. Each week, we watch a movie from one of the 12 content genres and complete a global foolscap worksheet. Then we discuss it using the six core questions. This week is our surprise bonus episode, and we're tackling the big idea nonfiction by analyzing the 2015 documentary In Defense of Food, based on the book by the same title by Michael Pollan, adapted for the documentary by Edward Gray and directed by Michael Schwartz. Here's a synopsis adapted from various sources, PBS, IMDb, and Wikipedia. Author and journalist Michael Pollan sets out to answer the question he is asked most by readers of his previous book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. What should I eat to be healthy? His journey of discovery takes him from the plains of Tanzania, where one of the world's last remaining tribes of hunter-gatherers still eats the way our ancestors did, to Loma Linda, California, where a group of Seventh-day Adventist vegetarians live longer than most anyone else on Earth, and eventually to Paris, where the French diet, rooted in culture and tradition, proves surprisingly healthy. He goes on to explore the relationship between the Western diet and nutritionism, and argues that nutritionism, which is the ideology that nutritional value of a food is the sum of all its individual nutrients, vitamins, and other components, has overcomplicated and harmed American eating habits, and that the science of nutrition should not influence people's eating habits because a full range of nutrients has yet to be identified by scientists. It seems the more focused Americans become on nutrition, the less healthy they seem to become. Faulty nutrition science and deceptive marketing practices have encouraged us to replace real food with scientifically engineered edible food-like substances, as he has coined it. Pollan argues that rather than focusing on eating specific nutrients, people should focus on eating the sorts of food, real food, that their ancestors would recognize. Food as it exists in nature, before it's been processed and tampered with, having nutrients stripped to promote shelf life and artificially added to be healthy again. All of this boils down to the succinct seven-word manifesto: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Embracing this simple approach, Pollan says, will allow us to rediscover the pleasures of eating and avoid chronic diseases so often associated with the modern diet. So that gives you a summary of the content that was in Defense of Food. And we're going to go straight into our editor six core questions. And Anne is going to take over with global genre.
This was a really interesting test because for most of us in the StoryGrid community, the genre of big idea nonfiction is the one we've probably studied the least. So recently we learned a lot from our colleague Shelley Sperry, who wrote a wonderful blog post on big idea nonfiction a couple of weeks ago. We'll link to that in the show notes. And in it, she points out that the big idea nonfiction acts almost like a subgenre of the worldview revelation internal genre, which I think is really interesting. The author of Big Idea Nonfiction is the protagonist who has been on a journey that changed his worldview. And that protagonist invites us, the audience, to come along and have our worldview changed too. So internal genre, worldview, and Michael Pollan's journey changed his worldview about how we eat, which is really fundamental. And he wants us to feel both the urgency and the simplicity of making life-saving dietary changes ourselves. And that life-saving is kind of a clue to what I feel is the external genre, because big idea nonfiction can also have that. In this case, how we eat is laid out as literally a matter of life and death. And that gave me a clue that we're looking at an action external genre. We perceive, or at least I perceived, and some of us are going to argue on this, the villain as the big institutions like government, big agri, big food. So I'm going with epic subgenre of the action story, which pits person against state. For the subgenre, action has a lot of subgenres. I'm going with rebellion, where the big state villain is visible. We know who we're rebelling against. The documentary introduces us to that villain over and over again in corporate mouthpieces, food labels, and advertisements. We probably can't overthrow it, but we can subvert or outwit it.
Excellent. Epic. It is epic. My battle with food is epic. So I can definitely relate to
yeah,
that.
I think we all.
So I think, Leslie, were you going to pop in here and talk to us a little bit about the way that you're looking at the external genre?
Yeah. So like the tipping point in defense of food is an intellectual action story within the big idea nonfiction. In action stories, the force of antagonism determines the subgenre and the sub-subgenre. As Anne said, there are a lot of subgenres within action. So Shauna said that the villain in all nonfiction is the human condition / environment because we know so little about what makes the world go around. I haven't studied it enough to say, you know, for myself, whether I, you know, wholeheartedly agree or not, but that's kind of where I started. So that would make this story action, adventure, environment. I'm tempted to call it, though, a labyrinth plot, which has a maze-like edifice rather than environment, because the confusion and misinformation around what to eat, if you want to eat healthy, feels very much like Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard to me.
Which is one of my favorite references of all time, just so you right. know, bringing up Nakatomi Plaza. I love it.
So one more quick thought on that is that the big agri and the food companies are definitely glomming on to this, taking advantage of this. But ultimately, I see the force of antagonism is this confusion around what to eat. And so that's where I would set that.
I really like both of those. So let's move over to the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. Valerie, will you walk us through those?
Absolutely. So in the beginning hook, Pollen states his credentials, his big idea, and explains that the Western diet is making us sick. And of course, this is pretty typical for a big idea nonfiction, where the protagonist or the author sets us up and hooks us early and explains why he is the best person to tell us about this. What I really liked about the beginning hook is that most of this happens during the opening credits. I thought that was fantastic. In the middle build, he restates his big idea and then uses ethos, logos, and pathos to convince us of the validity of his big idea. And in the ending payoff, we have the paradox, which is we think that eating healthfully is very difficult, but in fact, it's quite simple. We just eat food. So looking at this a little closer now, in the beginning hook, the inciting incident, as I said, happens in the opening credits when Pollen sets out to discover the link between diet and health. The hook that he gives us right at the beginning is fantastic. He says that the answer is not as complicated as he thought it would be. So of course, then we stay tuned to find out what the simple answer is. The progressive complication is that the Western diet is making people sick. The crisis question, if our current diet is making us sick, what kind of diet did we evolve to eat? What kind of food comes from nature? The climax then is when Pollen investigates mother's milk, which is the food we get at the very beginning of our lives. The resolution is that nature provides everything we need. This leads us into the middle build, and he spends quite a bit of time telling us about the Hadza people in Tanzania. And this, to me, is like a transition piece from beginning hook to middle build. The inciting incident then of the middle build, in my opinion, is that we can learn a lot from the Hadza people. And the Hadza people then represent our ancestors, the hunter-gatherers. And the lesson we can learn from them is to eat food, not too much, mostly plants. So right at the beginning of the middle build, we have the blatant statement of his big idea. The progressive complication is that we've confused eating food with eating nutrients. And this is where the idea of nutritionism comes in that Kim was talking about earlier, which I thought was fascinating. I had never heard of it, of nutritionism, or it explained quite that way. And I'm quite into food and nutrition, so that was fun for me. The crisis question is this. If the French eat such rich food, which seems to go against everything we've learned about nutrition and everything that Pollan has just spent an hour telling us about, why do they have better health than people in other Western countries? And he calls this the French paradox. The climax is that the French have a different culture around food than most North Americans. They eat smaller portions and they eat more slowly. And food is something to be enjoyed. It's an event. It's eating together. And the resolution then is that cultivating a relaxed, non-punitive attitude toward food is essential. He quotes Oscar Wilde here, all things in moderation, including moderation. And he also states that being anxious about your food is not good for your health. The ending payoff goes by very quickly. And in A Big Idea Nonfiction, the ending payoff must be a paradox, as I stated. And that is the answer to this really complicated question is actually very simple. That's the paradox. The inciting incident is when he says that we have more control over our food choices than we think. We actually do have power. And he cites examples, for example, food markets, grassroots movements, and so forth. The progressive complication of the ending payoff is that the food industry itself is at a turning point. And we, as individuals, are at turning points in our decision about what we want to eat. And I thought this was fascinating because in Story Grid Universe, when we talk about progressive complications and turning points, the turning point is the biggest progressive complication that forces the protagonist to make a decision, to change, to act, to move. So we've gotten to a point in our diet where what we are eating is making us sick. We're asking questions. We're searching for answers. We are starting things like food markets and other grassroots movements. And this is forcing the food industry to turn and to change and to meet those market demands. So right after he talks about this, he cuts quickly to Anthony and says that Anthony is also at a turning point. Well, Anthony in this documentary represents his entire generation, really. And I watched this with my daughter who's 14, and you know, she's a little older than Anthony is in the show. But she's also starting to look at these things. And I think that because of the types of questions that we're starting to ask now, her generation is really going to be the ones that pushes the industry over the top, which I thought was fascinating. The crisis question is this. Could the answer to our health problems really be as simple as eat food? The climax, or the answer to that question, is yes, it is that simple. The resolution then is a restatement of his big idea that he said many times over the course of the show, and that is eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Now, it's surprising and inevitable. Inevitable because, yes, nature provides. That's how we've survived as long as we have survived as humanity. Whether or not it's surprising, in my opinion, depends on how much information the viewer had coming into this. I'm a runner, so I'm looking at nutrition a lot. I've got one of my very best friends is a nutritionist, and I know other people who are in the field. So we're talking about food a lot. What should we eat to improve our athletic performance and so forth? So I had what I considered to be a pretty decent understanding of nutrition. So it wasn't as surprising to me as it would be to someone who is coming at this cold. So I would say, yes, it is surprising, definitely inevitable.
That's great. I agree that the deciding who the villain is in this story and deciding, you know, how you view it structurally has a lot to do with where you started. Now, as it happens, I knew all this stuff. I'm going through it thinking, yeah, well, we know all that. And I realized, ironically, that that's because I read the book Defense of Food many years ago, but also because I have lived in France. And it's such a beautiful approach to food that when he showed the people in France, that was the vindication for me. Like, yes, yes, I knew that. And to me, then it made it very clear that the villain is evil American big corporate food. And that's how we all approach stories from a personal level.
Well, and it's interesting, Anne. I would say that has to go even further than that. It has to be something even in our own anxiety to perform. There's all this rushing and hurrying and performance and all of this stuff that leads to a culture that then big food can take advantage of. When you were mentioning that with the French, I was jealous. I was jealous to be that at ease. I never feel that way about eating. What is that in us in America that says you must perform, you must achieve, you must do more, be more, all of those things? It feels like that drive that we've created as a culture that has now led us to big food being the solution to this other thing that we have in us that has now created this other problem.
One other quick question about the culture. Of course, I'm not in America. I'm not American. I'm in Canada, and we're a bilingual country. So I think his point that he makes in the ending payoff, at the end of the middle build, is that culture, our culture around food, our mindset around food, how we consider it, how we look at it, is a huge factor. Because if you move outside of the United States, there's all kinds of different differences. There's all kinds of differences. You know, when I lived in Ottawa and a lot of my friends there were Francophone, absolutely we had these gorgeous meals. But I'm in Newfoundland and we also have big meals that take a long time to eat, and it's a very different feel. Now, at the same time, Kim, I totally know where you're coming from. It's that constant balance. So when he says it's our choice, it is, but well, it's a heck of a choice, isn't it? It's a heck of a balancing act. So to the math. In the Story Grid, Sean talks about the math of fiction, and the Story Grid book is geared toward fiction, and that's cool. It also works in nonfiction, which is why we're doing this. But the math in fiction, he says, is about 25% for the beginning hook, 50% for the middle build, and 25% of the story is the ending payoff. And those are round numbers, but they generally tend to work. For nonfiction, the numbers are more like 10% of the story is the beginning hook, 80% is the middle build, because that's where the argument is being made, and 10% is the ending payoff. Now, just to be devil's advocate, I wanted to check this one to see how it measured up. I came up with the beginning hook being 25%, the middle build being 70%, and the ending payoff being 5%. So I'm hypothesizing that there's more flexibility in nonfiction around the math. However, I'm totally willing to be argued with about that point.
Jari, I think that's your cue. Go ahead. Yeah,
I mean, it is interesting because a lot of these big idea nonfiction books, in order to work well, the big idea has to be within the first 10% or less of the book. And even though the beginning hook of the movie goes a little bit longer, the idea is put right up front. You know, within the first minute, what his big idea is. You may not agree with him and you may have a little bit of apprehension about if he's going to prove it. But I mean, within a minute, you're like, oh, we're going to talk about food. We're going to talk about how we should eat. And his big idea question is, how do we eat to be healthy? So he takes a little longer in the beginning to kind of like ease you into it. And then, of course, takes a lot longer during the middle build. And then the payoff is just really quick. And it's nice that throughout the whole thing, he has these little rules, which I really love. Like one is like, eat food that rots. And you're like, oh, okay.
No. That way. It's so good.
But no, I agree with Valerie. I mean, it's really kind of all over the map. But the most important thing in big idea nonfiction is that your controlling idea, your hypothesis, has to be like crystal clear. And normally that's like the introduction to the book. In the introduction, everyone should know, okay, this is what this is about. And then the rest of the book, you're basically proving your point. And then the ending payoff is literally the conclusion or the epilogue that says, hey, you know what? You thought it was this, but it's really this. And aren't I brilliant? You know? So I think is sort of the way it has to work.
Excellent. So Jari, you're up next now to talk us through some of this big idea nonfiction. And also Leslie's going to jump in with the intellectual action adventure story, but we're going to have you guys cover the conventions, obligatory scenes, and all of the good guts that need to go into a good big idea nonfiction story. So Jari, walk us through what you've got for us.
Yeah, thanks. And a lot of this I took from Shelley Sperry's excellent blog post. We're just going to plug her all during this podcast because this literally came out a couple of weeks ago and
was
a great
excellent
motivation, you know, to not only do what we're doing here, but she really broke it down in some great detail, as well as Sean's. Sean's got a bunch of posts. And as I think it was either Anne or Kim mentioned, this is a little new for a lot of the people in the StoryGrid universe. You know, I'm a nonfiction writer, so for me, this makes a lot more sense. You know, we spend a lot of time on fiction and telling story, but a lot of the nonfiction stuff, the same exact things apply. I mean, you'll start to see that as we kind of go through it and Leslie talks more as well. So the first thing on the conventions or obligatory scenes or what we're actually calling elements, because a lot of times you don't really have like the traditional scene, is the first one is there must be an overarching big idea that is both surprising and inevitable. Valerie talked a little bit about this as well when she was doing the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff. And the big idea here is, what should I eat to be healthy? I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. And again, it's within the first minute. And that's a really important thing to get to suck us in. The second one, which Valerie also alluded to, is all three of the classic forms of argument and persuasion with his ethos, logos, and pathos. And he uses all of these throughout the entire film. And he has these really nice little vignettes where, you know, he sets it up. The Anthony, for example, we come back to Anthony and he pays it off. You've got the garden in the Bronx. You've got all these doctors. And so you have these nice little ways to not only appear to your logical side, but your emotional side and also the experts, which is really great. And even, you know, Michael not being a scientist, again, within the first minute, he sort of says, well, who am I to do this? And then he sits there and says, well, you know what? This isn't as hard as we thought. And all these people are asking me about this. And then he cuts back and forth to him lecturing. And so he builds his credibility kind of over the course of the film. The third one is tease the reader with narrative cliffhangers. I mean, this happens all the time. The Anthony one is the best example where it's like, what's going to happen to Anthony? You know, and every one of us, you know, me, when I was a kid, I was overweight. And so I really related to Anthony. I felt bad for him. And I know exactly that part of my problem was diet as well. And I just really felt for him. And then you also feel for, you know, a lot of the miscommunication and the people within society that, you know, are looking at this stuff and saying, oh, well, I don't really know how to eat. So you have a lot of that. There must be a big reveal, which is akin to the global story climax in a novel. This is number four. And then in this case, it happens at the end and it's like, hey, stop manipulating our food. Let's just eat food. Don't eat a lot, mostly veggies. It's pretty kind of like, oh, that's obvious. And number five is evidence from credible sources. The protagonist, Michael, he is credible because he's a journalist, but he puts in the alphabet soup of all of the MD, PhD, Harvard, Stanford to make his argument. Again, you need those kind of credible sources to sprinkle out throughout the film, which again, he does really well. Then there's the how to apply the knowledge revealed from the big idea. And this is number six. And he sort of does this throughout the movie with his little guidelines. Eat things that rot. Cheat every once in a while. Enjoy your food. Eat lots of different colored vegetables, you know? And then, of course, another one I favorite is only eat what your great-grandmother would recognize as food. I think it's right. Pretty awesome. Because you're like, yeah, grandma wouldn't know what Wonder Bread was, that's for sure. Which leads to number seven, which is these entertaining anecdotes that keep the reader hooked. And these are very well done in the film, where it's these little twists and turns. And I think the entertaining anecdotes with the cigarette commercials, the Harvard study on fat, his teaser about, I thought this was going to be more complicated than it was, but it turns out it's not. And that's just really great. Like, wow, maybe culture has something to do with it. Oh, maybe we're being manipulated. And these are just so awesome in the way it's presented and visualized. And so all in all, that's how you get people to continue to read and watch a film, especially when it's a big idea film. You got to have entertaining anecdotes or it's just going to be this boring, you know, academic, blah, 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 3-4 syllable words you can't even understand. So with that, Leslie, why don't you take us through some of the other obligatory elements, I guess, or whatever we're going to call them today?
So yeah, just in review, as our colleague Shelley Sperry explained, the big idea authors usually craft their stories to fit the rules of an external genre too, which provides much of the narrative drive of the story. So I'm using Sean's elements from a post that I'll link to the show notes for the intellectual action adventure story within the environment as the sub-subgenre. Remember that the life value at stake in the external genre is life and death. And while individual food choices on any given day won't kill most people, the habitual choices people make on a daily basis have a huge impact on their health, illness, and lifespan. So when we're talking action story, we're definitely going to have a hero, a victim, and a villain. So the hero is someone who sacrifices themselves to free the victims. Michael Pollan is our hero protagonist, but there are other heroes in the story, and they, you know, you might characterize them as sidekicks, which is another one of these elements. But I kind of also see them as heroes, the food scientists and educators. And I see people like Anthony Scavato as a hero too. So in this way, the heroes do battle with this confusing information and environment to free themselves and others and make more healthy choices. So the victims, it's called In Defense of Food, but the victim is not food. Food is doing fine. But the human eaters in general, and more specifically, people who are whipsawed by changes in nutritional advice. And even more specific, there's a lengthy discussion about people who don't have access to fresh food as much and who are economically challenged. And so they don't have, again, they can't go to Whole Foods. They're getting their food at the convenience store and that sort of thing. So the villain, as we've discussed, it's a little hard to pin down. I'm going to go with Sean and say that the human condition and our state of being in which we know very little about what makes the world go round. You know, eggs are bad, eggs are good. Fat is bad. Fat is good. Well, this fat is good, but this fat, oh, wait, no. So the human condition as a villain is assisted by these companies that sell edible food-like substances that are bad for people's health. And they spread information that creates that confusion and makes people feel the need to trust not themselves, but the so-called experts who are really selling a product. We also, in an action adventure story, have a destination or a promise. So think about this as the Emerald City in The Wizard of Oz. We're on a quest to understand and apply the big idea. So Michael Pollan's specific promise is that you can learn to eat for your health. There's a path or methodology. So you want to think about this as the yellow brick road. By following this clear path, we'll reach our destination. Here, Michael Pollan seeks to clear up the confusion about the links between food and health. So he uses his skills as a writer with an open mind, and then he tells people what he's found. So we have also sidekicks, like the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion. The sidekicks in an intellectual action adventure exemplify components of the global hypothesis. Well, what does that really mean? Well, the food scientists and educators that Michael Pollan interviews and talks to, they unravel this confusion and correct misinformation by saying, for example, you know, separate association and causation. Like, they're giving you little tools to evaluate the information that is on its face confusing, but it's not that hard. Again, you can decode and sort the BS from what's actually legitimate. And then we have set pieces and way stations. These are the sequences within a central drama that must be solved before the global story can move on. The stakes have to increase with each set piece as we follow the path. So, for example, Michael Pollan covers not too much or that aspect of the big idea last because he notes that it's the hardest thing to change. So set pieces within this film include food versus nutrients, nutritionism, diseases, what we've evolved to eat versus the diseases of civilization, why eat food, why mostly vegetables, why not too much. And then the final main element that Sean discusses is the hero at the mercy of the villain. And to me, so much of the film is showing us the hero, which are, you know, just ordinary people, food scientists or eaters, at the mercy of this confusion and misinformation. But I feel like it's most clear when we're talking about Anthony's story and during the poetry slam death recipe PSA that we really get a look at what's at stake and why it's a life-death value.
Yeah, I have made my argument for the villain being actual corporate big food. And one of the reasons that I landed on that is there is such a clear speech in praise of the villain right at the middle of the movie. It's at an hour and 5 minutes and 40 seconds it starts. And I won't quote the whole thing because it goes on at some length, but the Cargill representative of a big agri company at this big convention of food products, edible food-like substances and components, talks about children and how we're going to, you know, offer you something that your children will eat. And I began to feel like I was listening to Ned Beatty's speech in Network. I started to feel persuaded. And that's one of the keys of the speech in praise of the villain scene is that it has to be persuasive. I am totally on board with eat food, mostly plants, you know, not too much. And I started to think, wow, maybe this guy is right. So if you watch this documentary, look for that speech. It just leaped out at me because he's talking about children and life and the goodness and the sweetness. And it was wonderful.
It just to kind of sum it all up, when it comes to a big idea nonfiction book, these components of these elements that we're calling them conventions, obligatory elements, are really important to have in there. And it's going to be the way people are going to get really inspired by what you're writing about. And a lot of times there's people that have, when they're going to do this, they have this dilemma, do I do a how-to or do I do a big idea nonfiction book? And that's the real like struggle because a how-to book is not as complicated, right? It's, you do this, you do that, you do problem, solution, whereas this, you have to have a bigger idea. So, you know, don't be afraid of them, but know that if you're going to do a nonfiction book, you know, you could start out with a how-to and how that how-to will evolve. Because a lot of times, even in within a how-to, each part of a how-to can be a mini big idea. And you see this a lot in a lot of business books, for example. So just to not, you know, to encourage you to, when you think about this sort of stuff, don't get too scared. Writing A Tipping Point is hard. Writing Omnivore's Dilemma is hard, but each one of those adheres to all of these obligatory elements.
Excellent. Next up, we have, what is the point of view and what is the narrative device? Anne, walk us through that, would you?
Yeah, it's a nice framing device because we start basically with the camera on Michael Pollan and he's speaking in the first person. He's looking directly at the camera, which is to say directly at me and you. And he talks about the book he's written, which incidentally is also written in the first person. So there's sort of a double first person talking about first person. And then the camera, we sometimes shift because the camera takes us to places around the world where Michael Pollan is not present. So it takes on kind of a third person characteristic. But mostly it's Michael Pollan speaking in the first person about me and we and us and me and you. And there's almost a second person feeling to it because he brings in you when he's speaking, we see film of him speaking to a live audience. There's a certain second person you quality to it. But mostly I'd say it's first person with this narrative framing device of the guy sitting and talking to the camera, and then we cut away for different parts of the story and then come back to him.
Okay, excellent. It was very effective. And the way he opens with like, look, what do I know? Like he comes at it very humble and very approachable, and which was so just so refreshing, because I find these food documentaries very anxiety inducing and I'm almost like nervous to watch them. Oh God, it's going to shake up my whole way I look at things. And food has always been one of those things that I don't really know how to approach. So I could totally relate to what he was saying about people being whipsawed. And I was just like, right? Thank you, Michael. Like he was really talking to me. He was so calm about things, right? And he's like, this is serious, but the answer's so simple. Like, don't panic. It's a simple answer. It's within our grasp to do. And it was all very reassuring. And so just as someone who's, I guess, easily influenced by some of those things, they really do a number on me. And so I just really appreciated that point of view that he took. And it's not really like the headmaster, like telling you what to do very, you know what I mean? Some of them are very panicky. And this was just not that way.
As a narrative device, Michael Pollan has a nice blend of authority and approachability. I enjoy listening to him. He has a nice presence. So should we talk about the objects of desire, also known as wants and needs? The protagonist in this story, which is Michael Pollan and us, wants us to wake up to the life-threatening nature of the Western diet, and he would like us to outwit the villain. This is my point of view, with the villain being the big food, big corporate agra, by turning away from the food it supplies and forcing it to change, right? He needs a large mass of people to make these changes that he's advocating, because that's the only way the system will change. And meanwhile, the antagonist, again, I say big food, wants profits and needs to maintain the illusion that they are selling us healthful food, twisting their evil mustaches and it's all good for us.
Okay, so with that, lead us right into your controlling idea and theme for In Defense of Food.
Well, they pretty much hand it to us. We can just say, yes, it's eat food, not too much, mostly plants, because that's the big idea in this whole story. But to fit it to a story grid style format for the actual controlling idea, I decided to try this. Death and disease result when big food cons us into eating the bad diet it sells. But health and happiness prevail when we eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. What do you think?
Excellent. I love it.
That is, you nailed it on the head right there. You should definitely like tweet that to him and say, hey, you know.
Would that fit in a tweet? I'm not sure.
Probably not, but that's really great. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, we could go on our Twitter at StoryGradeRT. We should share the episode and we should tag him in it. I bet that would be really fun. Why not? So this brings us to one of my favorite parts of every podcast episode that we do, which is the good examples of. So these are kind of just these extra pieces, which we kind of already talked a little bit about Michael Pollan and just his narrative device of how approachable he is and his point of view that he uses. So I would say that is a great example there that we've already kind of talked about. And so just other things that really stood out to us about the specific film. Jari, you had a couple here.
Yeah, I mean, I just really like how he makes it not overly scientific. I think you can get really in the weeds with all the science, and it is just nice that he presents it in like a way that like your friend would talk to you about it. I think a lot of us have talked, have said that before. And it's just a great way to do it, because it's like, hey, I'm just a buddy. You know, I did some research. Let's go on this adventure together and like see how what we see, you know. And yeah, you know, this isn't that complicated. Well, you know, we'll figure it out. And it just makes you feel at ease. And I know, you know, a lot of us have some anxiety about watching these sort of things. I mean, I know I do. And it just makes it a lot more comfortable. And then the other thing that's really great, especially when he puts up at the beginning that, who am I? I'm not an expert. I'm just a normal guy. He cuts back and forth to this large lecture hall where he's literally talking about this, the food and having these jokes and anecdotes. And so as it goes along, you're kind of like, well, I mean, at least these 400 people think he's credible. And it is interesting that the crowd is mostly the granola Berkeley crowd, I guess, where he's from. And he uses good props, and he makes it, again, not so scientific and not so scary. And I think that resonated with you as well, Kim, and I know with most of us. So,
and I think it lends really to his big idea, right? I mean, his whole method of laying it out there for us, it is really simple. So yeah, there's all the science, but really, you know, it's almost like he has to use science to debunk the science. so that we know it's really this simple. I think it really is a good choice to actually promote his good idea by making the way we take in the information as simple as the big idea itself.
I love the way that there were these old advertisements and commercials that we might remember fondly simply because we remember them from childhood, or, you know, we may have a nostalgia for a time, you know, before we were born and that kind of thing. And how insidious that is, because we have, I don't know about you, but when the Coca-Cola song started, I was like, oh yeah.
I love that song. it's so bad, right?
And that's how insidious it is, right? Because it's, you know, we're all in perfect harmony. We're all like working together. Here, take this, drink this stuff that's really bad for you. It's that twist. You have this emotional attachment to food and to eating the way that your culture is encouraging you to eat. And you have to interrupt that, even if it kind of feels good. And the way that you interrupt that, which leads into another point, is the big idea is so simple and easy to remember. Eat food, not too much, mostly vegetables. You know, you could have that mantra with you all the time. But then there are also these other pithy statements that are kind of in support of the advice. They're also easy to remember. And it's almost as if he's trying to do battle with the ad slogans that we're inundated with from those big companies. So make water your beverage of choice. Stop eating before you're full. And so it's really a lovely way of fighting the edible food like substances. And the final, like, this is such a great example. The crisis question here is so clear to me. Are you going to surrender to the Western diet and wait for evolution to adapt us to it? Which he's like, yeah, it will, but.
That was really funny to me, that whole part.
Yeah. Or are we going to change the way we're eating? And that was just a lovely, it was, you know, big idea nonfiction. You want to be explicit about these things and not do it in subtext the way you might do it in fiction. So it's really upfront and clear. And he does such a great job of that there.
Yes. As you were mentioning that about his, those little statements that he does, I was thinking, oh yeah, because in the book, In Defense of Food, the subtitle is An Eater's Manifesto. And I just love the word manifesto. It feels so empowering. And so it's kind of like those, all of those little simple statements, those slogans, those ad slogans that we get to have now, they're like a call to arms, right? Like, and they're like, make water your beverage of choice. Like, they're very simple, but they're so simple that it empowers you to actually be able to do them. It's the Eater's Manifesto, and it's this new, like, oh, the new thing to do, it's do it the way we've always done it. It's that easy. Well, that wraps it up for this week. Great discussion, everyone. Thank you, Anne, Jari, Leslie, and Valerie for excellent editorial insights into In Defense of Food. We hope our discussion helps you and your clients write a better big idea nonfiction story. So links to the Fool's Caps and other materials will be in the show notes document. And we'd like to invite all of our listeners in the StoryGrid editing community. We would love to have you comment, argue with us on our interpretations. And if you have any favorite movies that you'd like to suggest for us to look at, just in general, reach out and connect to us on Twitter at StoryGridRT, RT for round table. So join us again next time. We're going to restart our 12 content genre cycle with a performance story, we think, Hidden Figures. This would be a really fun one for everybody to take a look at this week and follow along with us and come to your own general conclusions, and then we'll see how we line up. So thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next week.